less of that there is, the less there is of the five khandhas, the less there is of these five aggregates, these five groups of existence, the more happy you feel, the less dukkha there is, right? The better life becomes. And after a while, you start to understand that the more you withdraw from all of this dukkha, the more you withdraw from the five khandhas, actually, the better everything is. And you're starting to get a flavor for why it is that the five khandhas are dukkha, are a problem. Experience itself is a problem. The more you experience, the more suffering you have. It's almost the exact opposite of what people in the world say, right? Oh, the more experience you have, the more happiness it is. You travel here, you go this, you experience that. You know, all of this stuff, the more you do, the more happy. But actually, no. It is when you withdraw inside of yourself and simplify things, that is when you have the happiest moments in your life, far surpassing any experience you can have outside. So this is how you can start to get the handle on the idea of why of the five aggregates, or the five groups of existence that are subject to attachment. We attach to these things, right? This is us. We identify with this. We identify with our experience. And because of that, so these are all things we attach to. Very useful. If you want to reduce the sense of self, then of course this is how it happens, by seeing this as suffering. Yeah. So that is the first noble truth for you. And all of these things, they become much more clear once the defilements start to abate and disappear into the background, because your vested interest in these things, they tend to disappear, and when the vested interest disappears, you can see things much more clearly here. Okay, so first noble, the second noble truth. So let's have a look at this one. So this is how the standard phrasing of the second noble truth in the suttas. Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering here. It is this craving which leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. That is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for extermination. Right? This is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. The origin of suffering is craving. It is craving that drives suffering. Why is it that craving drives suffering? What actually is the what does it actually mean that craving is the cause of suffering here? And sometimes people would say that the reason why craving is the cause of suffering is because when you crave, you are by definition you are separated from what is pleasing, right? Craving is always about something you haven't got, somewhere in the future you hope to get this. So craving itself is about being separated from what is pleasing here. But that actually is not really, that doesn't mean that craving leads to suffering. That means that craving is suffering here. It's slightly different. That's already been covered by the first noble truth, right? So that is not really quite the right way of understanding this. And the crucial way, the clue to understanding what this means is the next word here. It is that this craving, right, this particular craving, which leads to renewed existence. This is a craving that is problematic. And this is why craving is the cause of suffering, because craving always perpetuates you in samsara, right? Five khandhas, you have finally discovered that the five khandhas are suffering, and yet, as long as there is some craving there, you're perpetuating these five khandhas into the future, life after life, existence after existence, eon after eon, right? Just keep on going, keep on going, keep on going. And that is when it becomes problematic. So this is the real reason why craving is the cause of suffering, why it drives it forward. So, for that reason, you want to overcome this craving, right? If this is the thing which drives existence into the future, it is the sap, in a sense, that nourishes the growth of beings in new realms, in whatever realms. You have to overcome that. And how can we overcome craving? You can't just stop it. right? You can reduce it when you come on a retreat like this. You can kind of minimize it when you meditate, and you can start to feel peaceful, and then you end your meditation, and it comes back again. It's very insidious. It's part of us, right? It's very much related to the sense of self. When you have a sense of self, the self wants to control things. And because the sense of self wants to control things, that is often what gives rise to craving. Craving and control, when all of these kind of things are part and parcel of the same thing. The sense of self wants to enjoy, right? I'm here. I want to enjoy this world. That also tends to lead to craving. So this second noble truth, the way it is phrased here, doesn't really tell us how to get out of this. Yes, we can understand how to reduce craving a little bit, but to understand how to actually overcome it, you have to bring in the idea of dependent origination again. And sometimes you find that dependent origination is substituted into the second noble truth. So instead of having the noble truth in this way, instead you have dependent origination in there instead. And what that means, of course, is that the real way of overcoming this renewed existence, once you see dependent origination in there, the cause, the root cause there, is avidya, is ignorance, delusion, not seeing things according to reality. That is how you can overcome this. And once you see things in accordance with reality, once you take away the avidya, the delusion, then, it is only then that craving can cease, because then that sense of self, which has this interest in craving, interest in desiring, interest in to get hold of things, that once that sense of self disappears and fades away into the background, then craving doesn't have any foothold anymore, has nothing to support it, and it can fade away as a consequence. This is how craving can be overcome. Again, it has to do with this delusion. You can see now how useful this dependent arising is, right? It really brings things back to the crux of the matter, what is important. This idea of insight, of understanding things in accordance with the reality. This is what really matters. This is what really is important here. So the craving that leads to renewed existence, right? This means rebirth, accompanied by delight and lust. Delight is nandi in the suttas. Lust, the Pali word is raga. It really means desire, right? Desire in the sensory world is really what it refers to. And the delighting here and there. There's no end to the delighting in the world. There's always new stuff, always new experiences to be had. You always keep on going. There's no end to this. Delighting here, now delighting here, now delighting there, now delighting somewhere else, keeping on going forever and ever, round and around. This is part of the problem. And one of the problems here with craving is that very often we think craving is good. We think desiring is something positive. Right? I was talking about this a little bit the other day. When we take away the craving from our ordinary experience can seem so meaningless. It is this craving and desire, this thing which kind of directs us towards the future, directs us towards kind of this, that kind of brings us hope, right? It makes life meaningful. We're desiring something. We're going towards these goals. We're trying to achieve something. This is what life is kind of all about to most people. And because life is all about that, if you tell somebody that craving is a problem, they say, but no, craving and desire are fundamental. If I don't have that, life is pointless. This is, you have to have these things. So actually, we have a very, again, strong interest in craving and desiring. To the point, I think, in some suttas, the Buddha says that we actually identify with that craving. We are that craving. We think that this is us. We take craving to be an aspect of the sense of self, of who we are. If you are craving, if that is who you are, then of course the idea of giving it up is quite scary, right? You don't want to give up who you are. This is me. You can't give that up. And then it becomes very difficult. You identify with that craving. And then this is why this is quite radical to say that craving is a problem. But of course, this is what you start again to see in meditation practice. The less craving you have, actually, you feel the opposite. You don't feel that you are losing in meaning here. You feel that you are gaining in meaning here. You feel life is becoming more complete. Life is becoming more fulfilled. Life actually gains in meaning when the craving disappears. And when you eventually overcome craving completely, you enter a state of samadhi. That is when, for the first time in your life, you feel complete fulfillment, complete satisfaction. No more craving. Craving is gone. And wow, it is such a wonderful thing when that happens. So be careful of that. This idea that craving is something good is very easy to fall into that trap, because that's often how it feels to us. And it seems to be a necessity, and it seems to be something positive, when in fact it's actually the main cause of the problem in the first place. And the main types of craving that the Buddha always singles out are the cravings for sensual pleasures, right? The cravings for all the things in the world, craving for existence, and craving for extermination. These are the main things that drive our interest in the world. Craving for sensual pleasures, right? The craving for all the things in the world, for relationships, for all the other stuff, the material things that you can have in the world. This is what that means. As long as you are attached to that, of course, you will not be able to attain the deeper happinesses of meditation. Craving for existence, right? Very interesting idea. This craving for existence is actually a problem. And it's kind of strange, but remember what I was saying before, that about the five aggregates. The five aggregates is what we identify with. So when you crave for existence, what you are craving for is actually experience itself. You're craving for the five aggregates. That's what you are craving for. But of course, once you see that those aggregates, that experience actually is a problem, is suffering, you stop craving for existence. You don't really want to keep on going, right? But as long as you have that craving for existence, that it means that you will perpetuate yourself into future births because you want to exist in the future. Craving for existence is always about the future. You are here now, so it has to do with the future. Tomorrow, the day after, next life. That is what it relates to. Again, it is very profound, of course, and very hard to overcome that craving completely, but it can be done. Craving for extermination, right? You've had enough. You don't want this anymore. You're getting old. The body is falling apart. Okay, please turn off the life support systems and allow me to die. No, says the law. You cannot die. We will force you to stay alive, even though you are suffering immensely and there's no future for you. We will make you live and suffer accordingly. And this is kind of the modern view very often, right? These days people talk about euthanasia, being allowed to turn off the life support systems when you had enough and you want to die. But it is very controversial in the Western world. I think one of the reasons why it is controversial is because of our Christian heritage in the West. The Western world isn't really very religious anymore. We have lost a lot of religion. There was recently I saw some statistics in a newspaper from the UK, and in a span of about 3 years in the UK, from 2011 to 2014, the people who did not consider themselves religious had increased from about 25% to 50%. Right, 25% to 50% the people who did not consider themselves religious. It didn't mean that they didn't have any spirituality in their life. They might still have a sense of the spiritual in a kind of broader sense, but they didn't really consider themselves as part of any particular religion. So this is kind of where our world is today. The world is becoming less and less religious in a traditional sense. But still, a lot of things are kind of, this past still influences us, it still attaches us. And I think part of the problem why it is so difficult for us to accept things like euthanasia, that when people have had enough, they want to die, okay, maybe that's okay, right? Maybe that's no problem. If they are making an informed decision, it's a good decision. Why shouldn't we be allowed to decide when we end our own lives? Why should anybody else dictate to us that we have to stay alive? I don't think there is any problem there from a Buddhist point of view, as long as people are making informed, wise, competent decisions. I don't think that there is anything necessarily bad about that. I don't think there's no bad karma involved, as long as you're coming from the right place, you're motivated by the right thing. So this is one of those things, right? Sometimes it is better to, sometimes that can be a better thing. So you crave, sometimes we crave for extermination. Sometimes that can also be a much more deeply felt thing, right? You've had a difficult life and you've had enough, you don't really want to be reborn again, you just want to kind of erase everything, you want to get rid of this whole thing. That can also be a kind of craving for extermination. And then when you get reborn, you say like that baby said, oh no, not again, I've had enough of all this. So that is the second noble truth, the origin of suffering. So make sure you don't attach to the origin of suffering. Make sure that you don't take that as yourself, because if you take that as yourself, you can be absolutely sure you're going to keep on suffering for indefinitely into the future here. Okay, then we come to the third noble truth, which reads as follows. And this, because is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering here. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, the freedom from it, non-reliance on it. The cessation of suffering is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, right? The craving that leads to renewed existence that we saw in the previous one. So again, this too is about renewed existence. This too concerns rebirth, right? The same craving again. So the remainderless fading away and cessation of that. So gradually you overcome this until one day craving disappears completely. So first of all, it ceases in samadhi. And eventually, you give it up, you relinquish it, and this means like you, what happens through insight, because you understand that it is problematic. You don't want to have any more suffering, you don't want to have any more experience, you had enough of all that, and then craving can disappear completely. Your freedom from it, the mutti, you are freed from craving, because craving is a problem in its own right, it's suffering in its own right. You feel a sense of liberation when craving is gone. Wow, it is so nice. It has disappeared. You are free of that. Freedom is always a very positive thing. If you're not free, it basically means you are in jail, right? That is what non-freedom means. So craving is like a jailer. It jails you. It says in the suttas that craving is like a slave driver. You are the slave to craving. Craving is wielding the whip, right? Making you run around, being restless, being agitated, all these things. So craving is, you are not free as long as that craving, that slave driver, is running behind you, keeping you on the move, etc. The non-reliance on it, the analaya. Analaya is related to the word the Himalayas, right? The Himalaya mountains. Hima is snow, alaya is the resting place or the abode of snow. So it's where the snow rests. There's no resting anymore for craving. Non-reliance on craving. The craving doesn't settle anywhere. It doesn't. You don't rely on craving anymore. Craving is gone. So that is the ending of suffering when that craving has disappeared. Why? Because when there's no craving there, you don't project yourself into the future anymore. Consciousness has nothing that it holds on to. We will see this again as we continue with dependent arising. When consciousness isn't holding on to anything, it is not settled on anything. It means the consciousness is free and it isn't really pointing towards anything in the future. There's nothing in the future that it is interested in. Craving is always pointing to the future, right? You're craving for sensual pleasures. You're pointing towards those sensual pleasures. You're craving for jhana. So you're pointing towards those. Well, actually, craving for jhana doesn't really point you there. But you have. Craving generally points you to the future. When there's no craving, no desire, no resting place for consciousness, it means that there is no future possibility disappears. Consciousness is not moving towards the future anymore. Yeah. Okay, last one. Last of the Four Noble Truths. And this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is this noble eightfold path that is right view, right aim or intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness or concentration they have here. So this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering, right? This is one of the wonderful things about the Buddhist teachings. It is not just doesn't just tell you the problem. It tells you the way out, how to actually overcome this. And this is the way out. So why is this the way out? What is it about this path that makes it the way out? How can these eight factors... Right, and remember they have a certain sequence. These things are not just random. They happen in this particular sequence. Why are they the way out? What is it about them that makes the way out? And really, what this path is about is it is a path of purifying yourself, a path of abandoning the defilements, of making the mind pure. That is what it really is about. So it starts off with the right view. And of course, the basic idea of right view is to understand that morality, kindness in the world matters. It matters how we act. It matters how we live our lives. And as soon as you understand that that matters, that is important, right? Then your aim, you start to aim. You have a purpose in the right way. And that purpose then becomes the purpose of purifying yourself from all those negative tendencies that drive you in the wrong direction. Purify yourself from all those defilements, all those problems. You're acting in a moral way. And then this path of purification starts off with the ordinary morality, and eventually the morality of the mind, which happens in right effort and also in right mindfulness, right? You are reducing the defilements of the mind. The less defilements you have in the mind, the more moral you are in a very profound sense of the word. You become very pure after a while. You can't even do anything wrong anymore, right? You try to say something bad, you can't say it. It doesn't come out because your mind is pure. You're pure at the very source of where all these things come from. Of course, eventually, when the mind is so pure, that is eventually what allows you to attain samadhi, the very last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. That is where the deep meditations become possible. They're only possible in a mind which is very pure. But for the purposes of what we're looking at now, the reason why this works is because when all those defilements are abandoned, the path, the Eightfold Path, is a path of purification, right? Because it is a path of purification, eventually it takes you to the state where all the defilements are gone. And because all the defilements are gone, all the distortions, all the wrong outlook, all the vested interest in existence, in sensual desire, all of that is gone. And when all the vested interest is gone, then you're able, for the first time in your life, to see things in accordance with reality. Now there's no distortion anymore. There's no the outlook is straight. You're seeing things in accordance with reality. And this is why, as I said, we said on the first day here, that samadhi is the foundation for yathabhuta jnanadasana. Samadhi, stillness, enables you to see things in accordance with reality precisely because the defilements have been abandoned, right? And then you can see how all of this then allows you to penetrate this first factor of dependent arising, which is avidya. Avidya has the possibility, or the possibility of giving it up when the Noble Eightfold Path is practiced in the right way by abandoning those defilements that are there to support avidya, support ignorance, support delusion, support wrong view, and all these other kind of things. Okay, so that is the Noble Eightfold Path. Of course, very interesting to look at the Noble Eightfold Path in more detail, because it is one of those very, the whole of Buddhism really it, to a very large extent, is about the practice, and not about the theory. So if you start reading the suttas, you find that a lot of them are precisely about what we have to do, how to overcome this, how to overcome these defilements, to enable us to see things as they actually are. Okay, so that is it. That is the Four Noble Truths for you. The Four Noble Truths are the umbrella term within which everything else in Buddhism really falls in under these Four Noble Truths. Whenever you read the Nikayas, the Word of the Buddha, you're really reading about the Four Noble Truths. And then from here on, we're going to come back again to dependent arising. Now we have just looked in detail at the first factor, and now we're going to look at how this all fits in. That's the next step here, how it fits in with the other factors. That's what we're going to start on next. So that is what we will continue doing this afternoon. In the meantime, please keep on enjoying yourself, and we'll see you again at 3 o'clock.